Lawyers representing victims have released a public list of accused Catholic clergy in Illinois. This new list is much longer than ones released by church authorities. Today, we'll hear from one of those attorneys and the Archdiocese of Chicago. Plus, crime-free housing rules are meant to reduce crime in rental properties, but landlords, tenants, and police are divided over whether these rules are too broad. And the backstory of Shawnee National Forest.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about some new crime-free ordinances that are being adopted by rental communities across Illinois. Plus, Shawnee National Forest is turning 80. It's our only national forest in the state. We'll talk about how it came to be. But first, just last week, attorneys representing clergy abuse victims presented a report which details the alleged sexual misconduct by nearly 400 Catholic clergy and staff in Illinois. This number far exceeds the roughly 200 priests who have already been publicly identified by Illinois' six Catholic dioceses. It includes priests and lay people who at one time served in parishes or schools or otherwise worked in Illinois, including 29 in the Peoria Diocese, 22 in Rockford, 23 in Springfield. Most of the priests have died or are no longer in ministry. We'll put a link to the report on our website at 21stshow.org. We've also already tweeted it out as well if you're interested in looking at that. And obviously, a note to our audience, we're going to be talking about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church for about the next 25 minutes or so. Especially if you are Roman Catholic, we would very much appreciate your thoughts on how you're feeling about this, how the Church has handled this. You can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet us. Our handle is 21stshow. If you prefer, you can also just email us. That's talk@21stshow.org. And if you email us, of course, we'll use your first name on the air. I'd like to start now, though, with Jeff Anderson. His firm, Anderson & Associates, has released this report, and he joins us now from his office in Minneapolis. Good morning, Jeff. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning to you. Nice to be with you.
Jeff, we've heard some of these names before, and I should mention the Illinois Attorney General's office is also investigating this issue. However, the number of accused abusers in your report, while it's more than who have already been named by the Catholic Church, is also significantly lower than the 690 priests that then previous Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan said her office had identified in its own investigation last year. Why was it important for you all to publish your own list?
Well, it was important for us and our firm, Jeff Anderson & Associates, to publish this report for really three reasons. One is we've been in the field working with survivors and involved in cases in Illinois and the Archdiocese of Chicago and others for over two decades. And in that time, we've learned there has been an underreporting of clerical offenders across the country and in Illinois. Second reason is when the Attorney General reported that they had received 690 individuals who may have been accused or committed sexual abuse, we knew we had to do more based on all the information we assembled. So we began to assemble across the state of Illinois, as we have in some other dioceses, all the public information available about all the clerics who have ever been accused. And then we collated that data, and once we vetted it through our system, we felt there was a public imperative to make the identities of those accused, publicly accused offenders of childhood sexual abuse known to the public to both help survivors know they're not alone and to alert communities about a possible risk.
Now, quite a few of these gentlemen are deceased. Why was it important to include those names on the list?
Well, many of those on the list are deceased, but if they offended a child while a cleric, the consequence of that is still evergreen in those that have been offended. And many, if not most, of those children that were offended years ago by now deceased clerics are suffering alone, thinking he or she is the only one. And they are blaming themselves, and when we make a disclosure such as this, it gives those survivors suffering in secrecy, thinking they're alone and thinking they won't be believed, hope and the promise of getting help, and it can be transformative. So we have felt that making the names of deceased offenders known publicly not only does public service, but does great service to survivors who are blaming themselves, thinking they are the only ones, and they are at fault.
So, Jeff, some of your clients have come forward in addition to the names of their accusers being made, the people they've alleged abuse being made public. I'm sure this isn't an easy decision, and I'm not asking you to speak on their behalf, but I wonder if I can ask you how your clients have been holding up since this report has come out?
Well, every time there is more disclosures, and in particular a comprehensive report such as this that we issued across the state of Illinois, it is for the survivors, most of whom, with whom we work, remain private and confidential, a real trigger for them, because it brings up both memories, and it also triggers some hope at the same time. So it can be a real trigger that brings up some of the pain and the sorrow of the past. But at the same time, when they see that more is being disclosed and transparency is being advanced, and they know that them having shared the secret with us and that together we're doing something in this sacred partnership that we enter into with them, it gives them a sense of power and it gives them a sense of hope. At the same time, it makes them in some ways relive some of the trauma.
To that point, by the way, if you need help, the toll-free hotline for if you are a victim of sexual abuse and you're looking for resources, you can call 888-345-2846. Again, that's 888-345-2846. The Illinois Attorney General, by the way, has also set up an information hotline if you want to report clergy abuse to the Illinois Attorney General. And that number is 888-414-7678. We will have all of these resources up at our website. Jeff, can I just ask you, from your report, are there any clergy that you listed who have been accused who are still serving in churches in Illinois?
Among those we identified publicly, there is only one who we were able to discern is currently in public ministry, and he is reported to have been already vetted by the Archdiocese, and their internal processes concluded that they felt he was safe to be in ministry. We felt, based on the information we had assembled, because there were two allegations made against that individual, and because that allegation was public, at least it was imperative upon us to include that individual in those among the publicly accused, and thus we disclosed that name as a part of this report.
We're speaking with Jeff Anderson, who's an attorney with Jeff Anderson Associates based in Minneapolis, about a report that came out last week with these names, these public names, along with pictures of these clergy who have been accused of abuse here in Illinois. We will come back to Jeff later. Thanks, Jeff. But I wanted to bring another voice into this conversation. He mentioned the Archdiocese of Chicago. John O'Malley is a special counsel for the Archdiocese, and he's on the line with us from Chicago now. Hi, John. Welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
John, so this roster that Mr. Anderson and his colleagues have released is more than twice as long as what the state's six dioceses previously have disclosed. And I know you can't speak for the other parts of the state, but I wonder if you can just speak for the Archdiocese of Chicago and help us understand why there's such a discrepancy here.
I'd happy to. The list provided by Mr. Anderson as it relates to the Archdiocese of Chicago includes 77 priests who are listed on our website of priests who have had substantiated allegations and have been for some time. That website has existed since 2006. There are additional 22 archdiocesan priests who are not listed on the website for the reason that allegations against them have not been substantiated. I think the most important point, however, is that all of them have been reported to public authorities. These are not new names, and these are not names that have been kept from the public authorities. When the Archdiocese receives an allegation of abuse, it reports it to the public authorities without making any judgment about the validity of it, and we have done that since 2002. We established protocols with the Cook County, the state's attorneys of Cook and Lake County, and with DCFS in 2002 to report all allegations of misconduct going forward. At that time, we also included a look back where we allowed them to review files going backward so that we can say truthfully that every allegation of sexual misconduct received by the Archdiocese of Chicago has been reported to authorities and in current time since 2002.
John, can I ask you about the whole idea of reporting it to the authorities? And I think there was a statement that the Chicago Archdiocese put out in response to this report, and I just want to read from it. It says, the Archdiocese of Chicago does not, quote, police itself. And it says what you've just said, that it reports all allegations to not just civil authorities, but to, you know, to the police. So I think some of our listeners might hear this and think, why doesn't the Archdiocese also police itself, given the extent of this problem within the Catholic Church?
Well, let me clarify that. I appreciate the question. The Archdiocese and other dioceses have been criticized in the sense that it is said they can't be trusted to police themselves. Our response to that was, we are not a police department. Our job is, if we have information of sexual abuse, which if true is a crime, our job is to get it to the police, who are law enforcement. Now, they have the initial opportunity to look into these matters. If they prosecute, we stand aside. If they can't prosecute for a number of reasons, we then conduct an investigation. So it's not as if we are not pursuing the matter. We give the public authorities the first opportunity to do it.
And so do you then also, when the public authorities are pursuing it, do you wait until that investigation is concluded before you begin your own?
We step aside and allow the authorities to do their work. But in saying that, we withdraw the priest from ministry pending that decision. So our issue is risk to children and fitness for ministry. And if there's an allegation of abuse that raises the question of risk to children, we withdraw the priest pending the resolution of it. So the priest does not remain in ministry while this process goes forward. He is withdrawn.
And then when you mentioned this before about claims being substantiated or unsubstantiated, what does it mean to have a claim be substantiated?
A substantiated claim is the culmination of a process where our independent review board concludes that there is reason to suspect the abuse occurred. And the mandate of the review board is to be the primary advisor of the archbishop on the issues of fitness for ministry and risk to children. So if a priest is in ministry and an allegation comes forward, the priest is withdrawn and the review board considers those issues. If the review board concludes there's risk to children or questions of fitness for ministry, the review board recommends the priest be withdrawn.
And how many individuals then are on that list as of today?
As of our list, as of today, I believe there are 77 names on the website list. The website list was first published in 2006. And obviously, it has evolved over time. Currently, there are 77 priests in the Archdiocese of Chicago who have had substantiated allegations. And their names are published, and the circumstances of their withdrawal are noted on the website list.
And so in regards to this particular report that Mr. Anderson has put out, what is the Archdiocese's thoughts on it?
The Archdiocese's primary interest is protecting children. And we've been working since 1992, when the first reforms were put in place in Chicago, to create a process where we are doing everything reasonably possible to protect children. We acknowledge that responsibility. We have the Independent Review Board. We have what we believe is the first assistance ministry that is responsible for reaching out to people who have been abused or believe they have been abused. Mr. Anderson, I know, deals with our assistance ministry, and I believe he has respect for the work that it does. As we go forward, and we've done this work now for a long time, I think the one thing we've learned is that this is not an issue that only relates to the Catholic Church. Any institution that is responsible for the care of children has this issue and has to be vigilant to deal with it. I think we've seen in the media recently and learned of things over time that there are other institutions that also need to be vigilant to protect children, not just Catholic children. So we're hopeful that society will encourage those other institutions, sports institutions, coaches, private schools, even our public schools here in Chicago, that also need to address this issue so their children are protected as well.
That's John O'Malley, special counsel for the Archdiocese of Chicago. We did reach out for comment to all six dioceses in the state, including Rockford and Peoria. We did get a response back from the Diocese of Springfield. After the break, we'll get to that. But I do want to thank John O'Malley for being with us this morning. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll continue this conversation talking about cleric abuse in the Catholic Church in Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about a report that came out last week. Attorneys representing clergy abuse victims have released a report that details alleged sexual misconduct by nearly 400 Catholic clergy and staff in Illinois. If you want to report information regarding clergy abuse, the Illinois Attorney General has set up a hotline, and that number is 888-414-7678. If you are a victim of sexual abuse of any kind, and if you need help, you can get that by calling a toll-free hotline number, 1-888-345-2846. That's 888-345-2846. We're going to have all of this information up at our website at 21stshow.org. We have been speaking with Jeff Anderson, the attorney in Minneapolis, whose firm represents victims of sexual abuse. I want to welcome Heidi Schlimp to our conversation as well. She's a national correspondent with the National Catholic Reporter based in Chicago. Heidi, thanks for being with us as well this morning.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Heidi, I just want to start by asking how unusual you think it is for us in Illinois to have a list like this being published?
Yes. So publishing the names of alleged abusers is something that victims, their families, and their attorneys have been calling for decades. And we have seen, you know, since this past summer's news with the Pennsylvania grand jury report and other news about sex abuse in the church, an increase in the number of dioceses and religious orders who have priests releasing names of the accused and people for whom allegations have been made against. However, we're still looking at only roughly half of the dioceses in the country so far have released names of accused. And so there's more coming almost every week, but we're still not there yet where we have this universal releasing of names of accused priests. There are nonprofit organizations, specifically a website called bishopaccountability.org, which has been maintaining a database of allegations for several years now, and that has even larger numbers than we're seeing from this attorneys releasing these names here and then also from dioceses.
Jeff Anderson is also with us, whose firm released this list in Illinois. Jeff, I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about, we know, especially after we just heard from the general counsel for Chicago's Archdiocese, what your response is to what he said about the list?
Well, I listened to John O'Malley, and his office and the Archdiocese of Chicago have definitely worked hard to work with us and sometimes against us, but working with us to get information out there. And they have released the names of 78 accused offenders who are diocesan priests on their list. The problem and the difference between their list and ours is that they do not list religious order priests who worked in the archdiocese, such as Jesuits or Franciscans, who are accused of offending in the archdiocese on their list. Thus, those names do not get reported publicly.
Mm.
And that's why our list and their list differs both in number and in content. The second issue that we have with the Archdiocese position is that indeed they do report to law enforcement, and they do so rigorously in our history. With them, it goes way back, at least recently. And there's no doubt that all these things have to be reported to law enforcement. But their reliance on non-prosecution by law enforcement is often misplaced, because more often than not, these reports go back years and the statute of limitations for criminal prosecution has expired. And the reason they reinstated the priest that was accused and is in ministry today is because there was no prosecution of that priest, but that's because the reports to a number go back so many years.
Now, they did say, he did say that they report them regardless of the time frame. But can I ask you another question, Jeff? Because I did want to know, we reached out for comment on this to all of the dioceses in the state, including Rockford and Peoria. And the only response we got, besides Chicago and John O'Malley, who we just heard from, was from the Diocese of Springfield and spokesperson Andrew Hansen. First, I just want to say that he offered, quote, profound sadness and deep sorrow for the shameful wrongs and evils perpetrated during a dark chapter in our church history. But the statement later added that this report is, quote, an impressive professional marketing brochure, but does not represent, as Mr. Anderson suggests, a thorough and diligent review of the publicly available facts. It is highly misleading and irresponsible. And I wonder what your response is. So let's take Chicago out of the equation now and ask about the other dioceses across Illinois and how you feel about how they're responding to this, as well as to what they said about this report.
Yeah, I read and saw the responses of the Catholic bishops in Illinois, and it's much like the response of the Catholic bishops in California, all of whom we sued, and same as in New York, whom we sued and made reports regarding their underreporting and failure to report. The reality is that they have a tendency and a practice in Illinois and the Catholic bishops across the country to adhere to secrecy first, and to want to protect those accused, and only make these disclosures and create a list when they're under some public pressure from survivors or litigation. As a result, when we started to release the list, only a third of the diocese had already made lists. Since we started to sue them across the country, now over 100 of the 197 dioceses have released lists, and very few of the orders have. The bottom line is that they're underreporting the numbers of the offenders, and they're not reporting all the names that they know are out there. And our belief is that there is an imperative to protect the kids first over the accused. And thus, we work hard to make sure that we put out the data that the public needs to know for the kids to be safe and err on the side of safety, not the privacy of the accused. And the Catholic bishops have a tendency and a practice to err on the side of secrecy and not reveal, and instead to more likely conceal.
That's Jeff Anderson. Heidi Schlimp is also with us. Heidi, I wonder, from your perspective as a senior correspondent with the National Catholic Reporter, you have covered, you're based here in Illinois, but obviously this is happening all over the country. And I wonder, when we think about what's happening in Illinois, former Attorney General Madigan began investigating clergy abuse after what was uncovered in Pennsylvania. That continues under current Attorney General Kwame Raoul. Do you sense that this notion of transparency is changing, whether we're talking about across the country? And I wonder how Illinois reflects on that.
Well, I do think there is a movement towards more transparency, but a lot of things get in the way of the church being able to be transparent. And so I'll just raise a couple of those. So you've heard this mentioned from the other guests, but for example, the problem of religious orders, so priests who are not diocesan or archdiocesan priests, who belong to religious orders, the Jesuits, the Dominicans are some of the better known ones. They have their own governance structure that is not directly under the bishop, even though they may be acting in a certain diocese. And so the dioceses who have released names of accused sexual offenders have often been reluctant to include diocesan priests on those lists. Religious order priests also are more likely to move geographically and be located in one diocese and then in another diocese, perhaps in another state or even another country. So keeping track of that and making sure that those, you know, especially when lists are released geographically by area, is difficult when we're talking about religious order priests. In addition, we have some discrepancy and not always people using the same kind of language. So I know Mr. Anderson has used the term credible. Is someone credibly accused? And, you know, some people have different definitions of what would be credible. Other people, I think Mr. O'Malley was using the term substantiated.
Mm-hmm.
Substantiated implies a higher level of evidence than maybe credible does. So some people think credible is a pretty low bar, and that even if there is one, or as Mr. Anderson has said, maybe multiple allegations, then that makes something credible. Something's not frivolous if it's credible. In other words, an allegation is made against a priest and he was, in that area or in that parish at that time when the allegation was said to have happened. Other groups, including the Conference of Major Superiors of Men, which is sort of an umbrella organization for many religious orders, uses the term established allegation, which is an even higher level of evidence needed. That's, you know, closer to some sort of reasonable certainty that this abuse allegation happened.
And so, Heidi, it doesn't seem as if there's even an agreement on the terms. It sounds like what's not even, it's there, the reporting process is not clear. When we say, quote unquote, the Catholic Church, that can include a lot of people, and that's not necessarily priests. And then even the terms are also not really clear. Can I just ask you then, I know last month the Vatican had a summit on sex abuse. I know that there in June, there's an upcoming U.S. conference of bishops. I know you've been writing especially about how younger bishops want to have this handled. What can we expect to see happen in June, especially coming off of this sex abuse summit that happened last month at the Vatican?
Yes, so the U.S. bishops have their annual, they have two meetings a year, one in November, one in June. And in their meeting this past November, which of course followed all the news of the summer, they did not take any action, and that was at the request of the Vatican to take reserve taking action on this issue until a couple other meetings had happened. Those meetings included a retreat of U.S. bishops that was held here outside of Chicago in early January, and of course this summit that you're talking about that was held at the Vatican in Rome at the end of February. So that gathered together not all bishops from around the world, but the heads of the National Bishops' Conference, conferences. So here in the U.S., that's Cardinal DiNardo. Also, Cardinal Stupich was at that meeting at the end of February in the Vatican because he was one of the organizers. So now that that summit has happened, and, you know, there, to be honest, there wasn't a lot of concrete action that came out of that summit either. So there were some promises of a papal statement to come that would address issues in the Vatican City. There's going to be some task forces set up to help countries where they haven't been doing much with this issue, and a handbook that's supposed to come out as well. So not a lot of concrete action, but now the bishops are freed up to vote on the proposals that they discussed last November and will be doing so in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Those younger bishops that I talked to are really ready to start moving on this. I'm concerned, and I have some sense that for the most lay people who are pretty fed up after decades of this problem in the church, that whatever they do in June may not be enough, but at least I think we're going to see some votes on some sort of action in June.
I just wanted to end, Jeff, by asking you one last question about how your clients were doing. We started this conversation by me asking how they were doing after the report was released, and I just want to ask what kind of resources they have and access they have access to in terms of support.
Well, the survivors have a lack of resources across the country, but there are hotlines and resources that we refer them to, state by state, region by region, region by region. The one point that was made that I think needs to be underscored is the role of the Vatican in Illinois and across the country and, frankly, across the globe. The reason these lists are secret and have been held is because the Vatican has protocols and practices that demands every bishop keep anything that is scandalous secret. And it is the Vatican that sets the rules and the protocols, and the Vatican that has not come up with definitive disclosure protocols that even allow the bishops to make the disclosures they should make.
Right. So it sounds like, Jeff, that's a lot of what you would like to see changed. And I guess we'll see also from the U.S. side, what happens in June with the Conference of Bishops. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank Jeff Anderson for joining us. An attorney in Minneapolis, his firm represents victims of sexual abuse. I want to thank Heidi Schlumpf for being with us as well, a national correspondent with the National Catholic Reporter. Both of you, thank you for being here with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
And if you're a victim of sexual abuse of any kind, and if you do need resources, that toll-free hotline is 888-345-2846. And if you want to report information regarding clergy abuse to the Illinois Attorney General, that hotline number is 888-414-7678. We'll have all of this up at our website. Across Illinois, dozens of communities have been implementing ordinances aimed at addressing crime in and around rental properties. They're called crime-free housing programs. Most say that if someone in the home is connected to a crime, the tenant can also lose their housing. Supporters say these rules help reduce crime. Some say these crime-free ordinances are too broad and disproportionately target communities of color. We're going to talk about this issue now, first with Mary Hansen, because she's been reporting on this for NPR Illinois. Hi, Mary. Can you just, before the break, I know we are almost out of time, but I just want to ask you what crime-free housing means when we're saying these ordinances?
Sure. So the crime-free housing ordinances, they can take a couple different forms, but kind of the most common one, they include an addendum to the lease. So tenants have to sign an additional part to their lease that says that they won't commit a crime, and they also won't have any of their guests or people staying with them commit crimes on the property. And if they do, then they could be at risk for eviction. So that's sort of the one piece of it. And then the other piece is what city leaders and police officers say is an education portion of it, particularly for the landlords. And so they view it as a way to sort of partner with landlords to help reduce crime.
Okay. So Mary's been looking at this in Rantoul. near Champaign, in Collinsville, east of St. Louis. When we come back from the break, we're going to continue this conversation with Mary. Kate Waltz is also going to be joining us. She's with the Sergeant Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. We're also going to hear from the police, who have also talked to Mary in the course of her reporting. We could pick up this conversation on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. Right now, we're talking about crime-free housing ordinances. Mary Hansen from the is a reporter with NPR Illinois. She's been reporting on this issue. She was just explaining to us, Mary, so when you're talking about the idea that there's this part of a lease, and I know you were looking at this specifically in Rantoul, which is near Champaign, and in Collinsville, which is in east of St. Louis, it seems kind of obvious, doesn't it, that I wonder if it's even necessary. Like, if someone commits a crime, can't a landlord remove someone from the property? Or does this need to be a special law in there?
So the way that these city officials and police officers talk about it is, you know, it's just sort of another tool for them to use. And it's a way for the city to sort of communicate with the landlords and for them to all be on the same page that, you know, this should be in their eyes, a consequence for crimes occurring on those properties. They said what they've seen sometimes is that landlords might not even know that things are happening on their properties. So they say it's a way of sort of communicating and sort of putting it out there that this could result in eviction, and that there's a sort of line of communication between police officers and the landlords.
Okay, so that's what supporters of these rules say, that they help reduce crime. Some say that these crime-free ordinances are too broad and disproportionately target communities of color. Kate Waltz is the Vice President of Advocacy for the Sergeant Shriver National Center on Poverty Law, and she's on the line now from Chicago. Hi, Kate. Good morning. Welcome to The 21st.
Good morning.
So, Kate, I wonder, when you're thinking about this issue, what is sort of just your broad sense of whether or not these are helpful, and especially when you're thinking about the tenant's perspective?
I think these programs are largely unhelpful. First, landlords already have rights under state law to remove someone from their property if there's been an allegation of criminal activity on the premises. But what we see with these crime-free programs is not a focus on serious criminal activity caused by the tenants that is harming the community and in the immediate neighborhood, but rather almost a strict liability standard where there's any allegation of crime or a high number of calls to the police, and that local government is pressuring the landlord and demanding that they evict the entire household, even where in cases where the tenant may actually be the crime victim, may be an innocent third party, or may have been the person who was calling the police for assistance.
And so I know that back in 2014, the Shriver Center looked at where this was happening. How many communities are we seeing across Illinois that have crime-free ordinances? Or I think there's also nuisance ordinances in there as well. First of all, let's first just talk about how many, and then maybe you can explain the nuisance ordinance thing.
So of combined, there are more than 100 jurisdictions in Illinois and counting that have some form of a crime-free program, nuisance property ordinance, or both.
And what is a nuisance ordinance?
A nuisance ordinance is similar to the crime-free program, but it is saying that certain things count as nuisance activity, which can result in a property being declared a nuisance, and the landlord is asked to take corrective action, which typically means to evict the household. And nuisance can be anything from trash in the yard to noise.
Noise would be the one, right, yeah.
Noise, or it could also be more than 3 calls to the police in a 365-day window, or it could be as serious as a homicide.
And right now, does it seem like these ordinances are up for interpretation, or do you think people understand the difference between, for example, the nuisance ordinance or crime-free ordinance and existing law that exists apart from these?
So how these ordinances are enforced really varies by jurisdiction. And so in jurisdictions that are aggressively enforcing these laws, what we have found through our investigations is that they make no distinction between a noise violation or a number of calls to the police versus serious criminal activity. They are issuing the nuisance citations to the property owners and telling them that they need to abate the nuisance, which, again, we believe is code for eviction. And so in other jurisdictions, they may have a nuisance ordinance or crime-free housing program, but they essentially don't enforce it. It's just there. What we are most concerned about are those jurisdictions who are aggressively enforcing it. And contrary to what they claim, we don't think these ordinances or crime-free programs actually reduce crime. What they, in effect, do is force tenants to suffer in silence and to not call the police for assistance when they need it. And so we've heard directly from tenants and from property owners where essentially there's an agreement, do not call the police if you need them. And that's particularly concerning for victims of domestic violence.
Right, that's what
but
I was
that's
just
the
thinking.
Message
right.
That they would get.
That's Kate Waltz, who's the Vice President of Advocacy with the Sargent Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. We've also been speaking with Mary Hansen in Springfield. She's a reporter with NPR Illinois, and she has been reporting on this issue. And she spoke with Rantoul Police Chief Tony Brown about this issue. And unfortunately, Chief Brown wasn't able to join us today. It didn't fit with his schedule, but we wanted to play a clip from Mary's conversation with him. Let's just take a listen to this.
We believe that if you properly educate and you give the landlords and property owners tools that they need and information they need, then you know that's probably half the battle right there of reducing crime.
Mary, what else did you hear from Chief Brown in the Collinsville police as well about these ordinances to the point of their thoughts on whether or not this is a crime reduction strategy, which it sounds like they believe it is?
Yeah, I mean, Police Chief Brown and Rantoul, he said, you know, there is a possibility that people, you know, kind of might get caught up in this unfairly, and they want to be conscious of that. But he said from his perspective that it does work, and he pointed to the Collinsville Police Department outside of St. Louis, and I talked with them. They've had a crime-free housing ordinance for several years now, and their police chief said, you know, they have seen a reduction in calls to the police, and they have, you know, had some targeted, you know, sort of multi-unit housing complexes that he said they used to get a lot of you know, a lot of calls of the police. The police were kind of constantly there trying to deal with different issues, and they've seen a reduction in that. And he says that that's a sort of, he points to that as proof of this ordinance working.
And Mary, I wanted to, you, when we started this conversation, you talked about how these crime-free ordinances, especially when they happen in Rantoul, there's sort of two parts of this, right? There's the actual law, and then there's the whole idea of education and cultivating a relationship with police. And I wonder, in Rantoul, does Chief Brown feel like people have a relationship where they can, tenants can be communicating with police to avoid the kind of problems Kate was talking about?
So the thing with Rantoul, their ordinance is very new. It just took effect January 1st of this year. So they started with educating their landlords, so doing these seminars where they sort of talk about what the crime-free housing program is, the lease that they have to ask tenants to sign, and then sort of ways of you know, kind of protecting themselves in their rental property, making sure that they're screening for tenants and things like that. So they seem to be focused mostly on the sort of education of landlords, and then kind of rely on landlords to communicate them with the tenants.
Right. So I wonder if we can talk about the landlord piece of this, right? Because there's really three groups that we're talking about here, Mary, right? We've been talking about tenants, and we've been talking about the police, but then there's the landlord side of this. And I wonder what sort of pressure or what options, first of all, is left for, like, what's supposed to happen with a tenant and a landlord when one of these ordinances is being enforced? I know Rantoul is newer, but for example, how does it work in Collinsville? If someone did violate this crime-free ordinance, what does the landlord do?
So it, again, it can kind of vary by community, but generally, you know, there's if a crime happens at the property, the police department, the ones who are enforcing it, frequently have a crime-free housing coordinator or assigned officer, and he's sort of looking through the police reports and checking the addresses to see if they're rental properties. And when they are, they send a letter to the landlord that says, you know, your tenant violated the terms of this crime-free housing ordinance, and here's sort of a summary from the police report about how they violated that, and so therefore you have sort of grounds for eviction. And then if the landlords have a couple of options. They can go through the eviction process, to do that you have to, you know, sort of issue a warning and go through the courts, and it costs them, you know, both time and money to do that. Or what often happens, and I've heard from different legal advocates for tenants, say what generally happens is the landlords, instead of choosing to go through that process, will the formal eviction process will just sort of make a deal with the tenants and say, you know, we got this letter from the police saying you violated this, and so you you have to go, and so there's not really that, they say there's not really that recourse for tenants.
Right. And Kate, I want to ask you about that in a second, but I wanted to just play some more audio. Mary, I know in Rantoul, you've been speaking with landlords about this, and you spoke with Wendy Foltz and her property manager, Stan James. Let's listen to them reacting to this ordinance.
The problem is with that, Stan, is that if you don't run with the wrong people, then you don't have those issues.
But how do you know who's the wrong people? I don't know who carries cocaine or carries a gun, and I got friends that do. But I don't know that for a fact. And if I'm with them or they're in my house and they walk out and they get arrested, like say, God forbid, someone came to your house and they walk outside and the cop knows them, they bust them, well, they've been visiting you. Guess what? I got to evict you and you had nothing to do with it.
Now, see, I don't agree with it. But, well, I mean, it was either sign it or move out.
Mary, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit of the backstory of that conversation there.
Yeah, so, to start, just to be fair, I mean, there are a lot of landlords in Rantoul who've said they're interested in this and they think it could be a good tool for them. Obviously, Stan, who manages that that apartment complex, is not one of them. But Wendy, she's a tenant there, and she signed the crime-free housing ordinance. And she said, you know, sort of at the beginning when she heard it, she said that, you know, that sounds like a good thing, that that, you know, that there won't be sort of people around her, living around her, who might be committing crimes, or, you know, that she felt like it would be something that made it safe. And then as the sort of conversation unfolded, and Stan shared some of his concerns about, you know, they can, you know, the police can say, well, this person's been visiting you, so you're sort of responsible for those actions, it sort of changed her view a little bit on that, on what the effect of these ordinances might be.
And Kate, I wonder what options are left for the tenant when we're thinking about this.
Very few. One of the big issues with the crime-free programs and ordinances is they don't give direct notice to the tenants. And so in many cases where the landlord is being told that they have to evict the tenant, even then the tenant is not told. When we've talked to tenants, they will say, I was just told I had to be out by the end of the week. And they weren't given any explanation. Oftentimes we're the first ones to tell them. So they have no ability to mount a defense. And many have very strong defenses, including that it wasn't them, that they were the ones that called the police, that they were the crime victim. And so there's a very troubling due process problem with virtually all the ordinances and programs in Illinois. And we've raised it with many, many local governments, but they haven't set up a structure so that tenants have notice.
Kate, are you guys thinking about pursuing legal action then if you're raising these issues?
So one of the challenges, because tenants don't have notice to begin with, is then they don't know to call someone for legal assistance. They may not be aware of the fact that their legal rights have been violated. We do have a pending lawsuit against the city of Peoria in federal court for the enforcement of its nuisance ordinance.
That's Kate Waltz, Vice President of Advocacy for the Sargent Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. Mary Hansen has also been with us reporting on this for NPR Illinois. Mary, Kate, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What questions, by the way, do you have about housing here in Illinois? You can visit askthe21st.org. Our friends at the Illinois Newsroom have been doing a series of stories about this topic. You can reach out and share any questions you have around housing, buying or renting a home. Again, that's askthe21st.org. And if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area this evening, our friends at the Illinois Newsroom are hosting a conversation about affordable housing. I will be moderating. It's tonight at 5:30 at Riggs Beer Company. If you're in town, come out. And that does it for us today. Coming up on the program tomorrow, Democrats in the State House are starting to work on legalizing recreational marijuana in Illinois. We're going to talk about what this would mean from an economic and financial standpoint with State Treasurer Michael Frerichs. Our website, 21stshow.org, is a great resource whether you want to find past shows, information about today's shows, or giving us feedback. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.